more evidence that HPV vaccination is a good thing.
Can we develop a better vaccine to prevent shingles?
More babies, unfortunately, suffering from mom's substance abuse during pregnancy.
And is a filter to prevent recurrent blood clots to the lung effective?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on May 1st, 2015, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, and president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul F. Foster School of Medicine.
And currently in Boston, not even in Texas. Rick, how about if we start with one that's been an ongoing issue? We reported it low these many years ago. I'm not even sure how long ago. That was the vaccine for human papillomavirus infection and the burgeoning amount of evidence that, in fact, not only is this vaccine effective, it's also a good idea. That's according to a study in this week's Pediatrics.
We know that 70 to 90% of cervical cancers and also anal genital warts are caused by human papillomavirus, four particular strains. That's why we've developed what's known as a quadrivalent vaccine. The investigators attempted to assess the effectiveness of the vaccination program by looking at girls in the 8th or 9th grade who were enrolled before the vaccination was available as a national program, and then afterwards, and they followed them until grades 10 through 12. And what they determined was, for girls that were eligible, the vaccination program was effective in reducing the risk of cervical dysplasia, that is abnormal cells in the cervix, by 21%. And those girls that got all three doses of the vaccination, and by the way, only about 50% did, it reduced the risk of cervical dysplasia by 44%. So this suggests that the early benefits of this vaccination program among girls aged 14 to 17 is pretty good. And it argues that we really shouldn't be delaying the program until later age.
As we've talked about before, I think that our standpoint on this has to be that this is a vaccine that's capable of preventing cancer. And it's not one that empowers girls to think that they can have unprotected sex without consequence. And this study supports that notion.
That's a great point. Even though this is available in many countries, oftentimes children don't get it because the parents really don't see it as a way of preventing cancer. And in truth, as parents, we tend to underestimate our child's sexual experiences. So by delaying the vaccination until later, many of the kids have already gotten infected. So again, this is a cancer prevention vaccination. It does not promote sexual promiscuity, and studies have shown that.
And just also as a public health note, young boys, of course, are also eligible for vaccination with the idea that ultimately it would avoid oropharyngeal cancers in the long haul. Since we're talking about vaccines then, let's turn to the other end of the age trajectory to older folks, those who are potentially at risk for infection with herpes zoster, the causative virus for chickenpox. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine, a new vaccine for that purpose.
Elizabeth, many people probably already know that about 90% of adults have had chickenpox at some point. What they may not realize is that this is the cause of shingles later in life. It stays dormant for decades, and then later on it can reappear, and it causes primarily a rash, but more importantly, a substantial amount of pain associated with that rash. After the infection, we call it post-herpetic neuralgia, and that can persist for months and years after an individual has had shingles. And the older we get, the more likely we are to develop shingles, so that it's estimated that by the age 80, 50% of elderly individuals will have had shingles. The older you are, the more likely you are to develop persistent pain afterwards. So we'd like to be able to prevent that. Now, we have currently a vaccine on the market. It's a live attenuated vaccine. That means it's less likely to cause disease than the regular vaccine. The trouble is you can't give it to people that are immunocompromised. And the other thing is that it's less effective in the elderly. If you receive it after the age of 70, it's only about 40% effective. So we need a new vaccine. And that's what this study attempted to address. They used a subunit of the particular virus. They attached it to a booster, what's called an adjuvant. In over 15,000 participants over the age of 50, half received placebo and half received this new vaccine. The overall vaccine effectiveness against shingles was 97%, and it did not diminish with age. That means it was just as effective in individuals over the age of 70 as those between the ages of 50 and 70.
How can we account for that? What precisely was done with this particular vaccine that's rendered it so much more effective?
Well, it's a combination of two things. It's targeting the right part of the virus and hooking it up with the appropriate dose of this adjuvant or this booster. This suggests that it could also be potentially given to people that are already immunocompromised. Now, the downside is, because it was effective, 80% of individuals developed some sort of a mild reaction, either pain at the injection site that required two injections, or myalgias, that is muscle tenderness. It usually lasts for a day or two. And by the way, it didn't prevent people from getting their second dose.
Sounds like an effective strategy, and one that could also be potentially employed for lots of other troublesome viruses out there. How long before we expect this thing to get rolled out?
Well, this was a phase 3 trial. There's another study going on now, particularly targeting people over the age of 70. And I would predict when that becomes available, there would be submission of this to the FDA for approval. So sometime, hopefully, over the next year or so.
Okay, good news. From here, let's turn to something that's also in the New England Journal of Medicine that's not good news. In spite of lots of public health information and education out there regarding the need for women who are pregnant to really avoid a lot of different exposures, including alcohol and other drugs of abuse, we're seeing that the number of kids, the number of infants who are suffering from neonatal abstinence syndrome is increasing.
And that syndrome is a drug withdrawal syndrome. Commonly occurs in babies that are exposed in utero to opioids. Now, in the past, it's been primarily illicit drugs, but now it's commonly due to mothers that are just receiving painkillers, commonly prescribed by physicians. What this study tried to address was the incidence of this neonatal abstinence syndrome. When the baby's born, they suffer from hypertonia, muscle rigidity, autonomic instability, their blood pressures go up or down, fevers as well. They're irritable, have a poor sucking reflex, and a small number actually develop seizures. So they surveyed a pediatrics database that looks at about 20% of all the ICU admissions for kids in the United States. Among 675,000 infants, they identified that about 2% had neonatal abstinence syndrome. And from 2004 to 2013, the rate increased 4 to 5-fold. They stay in the hospital an average of about 3 weeks. So this ends up being a significant problem and increasing over the last decade to decade and a half.
Clearly important to bring this to awareness. What else can we do to try to stem this tide?
Well, I think recognizing that in the past it was due to illicit drug use, but now it's due to painkiller use, we need to make mothers aware that this could be an issue for their unborn child. We need to have better ways to prevent this syndrome. We spend a lot of time trying to make sure people don't suffer from pain. And as a result, some of these medications have been prescribed, some have been misused, and this is obviously a poor outcome related to that.
Mm-hmm. Finally, then, let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. For folks who have pulmonary embolism, does it help if we use a filter in their big old blood vessel called the inferior vena cava to try to make sure that we don't make the problem worse?
And blood clots to the lung usually originate from blood clots in the legs. Those blood clots in the legs travel up to the lung where they can cause significant issues and sometimes death. And if you've had one blood clot already, the treatment for that is typically to put people on a blood thinner to prevent another one, because a second one can actually be fatal in survivors of the first one. So it's routine to give blood thinners. The next question is, if we actually put a filter in the big vein, the inferior vena cava, in addition to anticoagulation, can that be helpful? Now, although we haven't had good randomized trials, the use of these IV filters has increased substantially. And some people said, well, gosh, if leaving a filter in there could be beneficial, leaving it in longer might actually be harmful because it can be where a clot could form. So we now have these retrievable filters. You can put them in and leave them in there for 3 months and then take them out. So what these authors address is, if we take a group of individuals who have had a pulmonary embolism, a blood clot to the lung, and are high risk for a second one, is putting a filter in addition to anticoagulation better than anticoagulation or a blood thinner alone? And so in this randomized trial, in which all individuals got anticoagulation but half got an IVC filter, what they discovered was the use of this retrievable filter, putting it for 3 months and taking it away, was no better than anticoagulation alone in reducing the risk of either symptomatic pulmonary embolism or in improving mortality at 1 year. So despite the fact that these are used frequently, there's no benefit in this particular patient population.
Well, isn't that interesting? That's another one of those assertions that I think a priori we would have said, well, of course, it makes sense to put this thing in there and then to make sure that you get it out of there eventually. And now, oh, objective data shows it's actually the contrary.
And in fact, about 10% of patients develop some sort of a complication related to putting it in. It's an invasive procedure, so some of them develop bleeding at the site, infections. Other individuals, they couldn't get the filter out. So not only was it not effective, but it carries a small risk of adverse side effects as well.
Okay, good to know. On that note, in the blog this week, I'm going to talk about the neonatal abstinence syndrome in New England Journal of Medicine. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.